style, the larger problem was embedded within the political culture of post-revolutionary America itself. The requirements of the American Revolution, in effect, cut both ways at once. To secure the revolution and stabilize its legacy on a national level required a dominant leader who focused the energies of the national government in one singular character. Washington had committed himself to that cause, and in so doing he had become the beneficiary of its political imperatives, effectively being cast in the role of a Republican king who embodied national authority more potently and more visibly than any collective body like Congress could possibly convey. At the very core of the revolutionary legacy, however, was a virulent hatred of monarchy and an inveterate suspicion of any consolidated version of political authority. A major tenet of the American Revolution, Jefferson had given it lyrical expression in the Declaration of Independence, was that all kings, and not just George III, were inherently evil. The very notion of a Republican king was a repudiation of the spirit of 76 and a contradiction in terms. Washington's presidency had become trapped within that contradiction. He was living the great paradox of the early American Republic. What was politically essential for the survival of the infant nation was ideologically at odds with what it claimed to stand for. He fulfilled his obligations as a singular character so capably that he seemed to defy the Republican tradition itself. He had come to embody national authority so successfully that every attack on the government's policies seemed to be an attack on him. This is the essential context for grasping Washington's motives for leaving public office in 1796. By resigning voluntarily, he was declaring that his deepest allegiances, like those of his critics, were thoroughly Republican. He was answering them not with words, but with one decisive, unanswerable action. And this is also the proper starting point for understanding the words he left as his final valedictory, the farewell address. Washington was making his ultimate statement as America's first and last benevolent monarch. Whatever the farewell address has come to mean over the subsequent two centuries of its interpretive history, Washington intended it as advice to his countrymen about how to sustain national unity and purpose, not just without him, but without a king. The main themes of the farewell address are just as easy to state succinctly as they are difficult to appreciate fully. After declaring his irreversible intention to retire, Washington devoted several paragraphs to the need for national unity. He denounced excessive partisanship, most especially when it took the form of political parties pursuing a vested ideological agenda, or sectional interest groups oblivious to the advantages of cooperation. The rest of the farewell address was then devoted to foreign policy, calling for strict American neutrality and diplomatic independence from the tangled affairs of Europe. He did not use the phrase entangling alliances, so often attributed to him. Jefferson actually coined it in his first inaugural address, 1801. But Washington's message of diplomatic independence from Europe preceded Jefferson's words to the same effect. Taken together, his overlapping themes lend themselves to easy summary: unity at home and independence abroad. It was that simple. The disarming simplicity of the statement, combined with its quasi-Delphic character, has made the farewell address a perennial candidate for historical commentary. Throughout the 19th and most of the 20th centuries, the bulk of attention focused on the foreign policy section, advocates of American isolationism citing it as the classic statement of their cause, others arguing that strict isolation was never Washington's intention, or that America's emergence as a world power has rendered Washington's wisdom irrelevant. More recently, The early section of the farewell address has been rediscovered, its plea for a politics of consensus serving as a warning against single-issue political movements or against the separation of America into racial, ethnic, or gender-based constituencies. Like the classic it has become, the farewell address has demonstrated the capacity to assume different shapes in different eras, to change color, if you will, in varying shades of light. Although Washington's own eyes never changed color and were set very much on the future, he had no way of knowing, much less influencing, the multiple meanings that future generations would discover in his words. The beginning of all true wisdom concerning the farewell address is that Washington's core insights were firmly grounded in the lessons he had learned as America's premier military and civilian leader during the Revolutionary era. Unless one believes that ideas are like migratory birds that can fly unchanged from one century to the next, the only way to grasp the authentic meaning of his message is to recover the context out of which it emerged. Washington was not claiming to offer novel prescriptions based on his original reading of philosophical treatises or books. Quite the opposite. He was reminding his countrymen of the venerable principles he had acquired from personal experience, principles so obvious and elemental that they were at risk of being overlooked by his contemporaries, and so thoroughly grounded in the American Revolution that they are virtually invisible to a more distant posterity. First, it is crucial to recognize that Washington's extraordinary reputation rested less on his prudent exercise of power than on his dramatic flair at surrendering it. He was, in fact, a veritable virtuoso of exits. Almost everyone regarded his retirement of 1796 as a repeat performance of his resignation as commander of the Continental Army in 1783. Back then, faced with a restive and unpaid remnant of the victorious army quartered in Newburgh, New York, he had suddenly appeared at a meeting of officers who were contemplating insurrection. The murky plot involved marching on the Congress and then seizing a tract of land for themselves in the West, all presumably with Washington as their leader. He summarily rejected their offer to become the American Caesar and denounced the entire scheme as treason to the cause for which they had fought. Then, in a melodramatic gesture that immediately became famous, he pulled a pair of glasses out of his pocket. "Gentlemen, you will permit me to put on my spectacles," he declared rhetorically, "for I have not only grown gray, but almost blind in service to my country." Upon learning that Washington intended to reject the mantle of emperor, no less an authority than George III allegedly observed, "If he does that, he will be the greatest man in the world." True to his word, on December 22, 1783, Washington surrendered his commission to the Congress, then meeting in Annapolis. "Having now finished the work assigned me," he announced, "I now retire from the great theater of action." In so doing, he became the supreme example of the leader who could be trusted with power because he was so ready to give it up. Second, when Washington spoke about the need for national unity in 1796, his message resonated with all the still fresh memories of his conduct during the Revolutionary War. Although he actually lost more battles than he won, and although he spent the first 2 years of the war making costly tactical mistakes that nearly lost the American Revolution at its very start, by 1778 he had reached an elemental understanding of his military strategy, namely that captured ground, what he termed a war of posts, was virtually meaningless. The strategic key was the Continental Army. If it remained intact as an effective fighting force, the American Revolution remained alive. The British Army could occupy Boston, New York, and Philadelphia, and it did. The British Navy could blockade and bombard American seaports with impunity, and it did. The Continental Congress could be driven from one location to another like a covey of pigeons, and it was. But as long as Washington held the Continental Army together, the British could not win the war, which in turn meant that they would eventually lose it. Like all of Washington's elemental insights, this one seems patently obvious only in retrospect. A score of genuinely brilliant military leaders who also confronted a superior enemy force, Hannibal, Robert E. Lee, and Napoleon come to mind, were eventually defeated because they presumed that victory meant winning battles. Washington realized it meant sustaining the national purpose as embodied in the Continental Army. Space and time were on his side if he could keep the army united until the British will collapsed. And that is precisely what happened. Third, when Washington talked about independence from foreign nations, his understanding of what American independence entailed cut much deeper than the patriotic veneer customarily suggested by the term. Once again, the war years shaped and hardened his convictions on this score, though the basic attitudes on which they rested were in place long before he assumed command of the Continental Army. Simply put, Washington had developed a view of both personal and national independence that was completely immune to sentimental attachments or fleeting ideological enthusiasms. He was a rock-ribbed realist who instinctively mistrusted all visionary schemes dependent on seductive ideals that floated dreamily in men's minds, unmoored to the more prosaic but palpable realities that invariably spelled the difference between victory and defeat. At its psychological nub, Washington's inveterate realism was rooted in his commitment to control over himself and over any and all events with the power to determine his fate. At its intellectual core, it meant he was the mirror image of Jefferson, for whom ideals were the supreme reality, and whose inspirational prowess derived from his confidence that the world would eventually come around to fit the pictures he had in his head. Washington, however, regarded all such pictures as dangerous dreams. In 1778, for example, at a time when patriotic propagandists were churning out tributes to the superior virtue of the American cause, Washington confided to a friend that, though virtue was both a wonderful and necessary item, it was hardly sufficient to win the war. "Men may speculate as they will," he wrote. "They may draw examples from ancient story of great achievements performed by its influence, but whoever builds upon it as a sufficient basis for conducting a long and bloody war will find themselves deceived in the end. For a time it may of itself be enough to push men to action, to bear much, to encounter difficulties, but it will not endure unassisted by interest." Another example. In 1780, Major John André was captured while attempting to serve as a British spy in league with Benedict Arnold to produce a major strategic debacle on the Hudson River at West Point. By all accounts, André was a model British officer with impeccable manners who had the misfortune to be caught doing his duty. Several members of Washington's staff, including Hamilton, pleaded that André's life be spared because of his exceptional character. Washington dismissed the requests as sentimental, pointing out that if André had succeeded in his mission, it might very well have turned the tide of the war. The staff then supported André's gallant request that he be shot like an officer rather than hanged as a spy. Washington also rejected this request, explaining that André, regardless of his personal attractiveness, was no more and no less than a spy. He was hanged the next day. A final example. Shortly after the French entry into the war in 1778, several members of the Continental Congress began to lobby for a French invasion of Canada, arguing that the likelihood of French military success was greater because Canada was populated mainly by Frenchmen. Washington opposed the scheme on several grounds, but confided his deepest reasons to Henry Laurens, president of the Continental Congress. He feared the introduction of a large body of French troops into Canada and putting them in possession of the capital of that province, attached to them by all the ties of blood, habits, manners, religion, and former connections of government. The French were America's providential allies, to be sure, but once they were ensconced in Canada, it would be foolish to expect them to withdraw. I fear this would be too great a temptation to be resisted by any power actuated by the common maxims of national policy. He went on to offer his advice to the Congress in one of his clearest statements about the motives governing nations. "Men are very apt to run into extremes," he explained. "Hatred to England may carry some into an excess of confidence in France. I am heartily disposed to entertain the most favorable sentiments of our new ally, and to cherish them in others to a reasonable degree. But it is a maxim founded on the universal experience of mankind that no nation is to be trusted farther than it is bound by its interest, and no prudent statesman or politician will venture to depart from it." There was no such thing as a permanent international alliance, only permanent national interests. The clearest statement Washington ever made on America's national interest came in his circular letter of 1783, the last of his annual letters to the state governments as commander-in-chief. He projected a panoramic and fully continental vision of an American empire, and he expressed his vision in language that, at least for one moment, soared beyond the usual prosaic boundaries of his subdued style. "The citizens of America, placed in the most enviable condition as the sole lords and proprietors of a vast tract of continent, comprehending all the various soils and climates of the world and abounding with all the necessaries and conveniences of life, are now, by the late satisfactory pacification, acknowledged to be possessed of absolute freedom and independency. They are, from this period, to be considered as actors on a most conspicuous theater, which seems to be peculiarly designed by Providence for the display of human greatness and felicity." The breathtaking sweep of this vision is remarkable. Washington had spent his young manhood fighting with the British to expel the French from North America. With the victory in the American Revolution, the English had then been expelled. The entire continent was now a vast American manor within which the people could expand unrestricted by foreign opposition. Presumably, the Native Americans would be assimilated or conquered, and the Spanish west of the Mississippi, Spain being Spain, would serve as a mere holding company until the American population swept over them. Within the leadership of the revolutionary generation, Washington was, if not unique, at least unusual for never having traveled or lived in Europe. His only foreign excursion was to Barbados as a young man. His angle of vision for the new American nation was decidedly Western. The chief task facing the next several generations was to consolidate control of the North American continent. Anything that impaired or deflected that central mission was to be avoided at all costs. In the same circular letter, he laid down the obligations and opportunities implicit in his national vision, again in some of the most poetic language he ever wrote. "The foundation of our empire was not laid in the gloomy age of ignorance and suspicion, but at an epoch when the rights of mankind were better understood and more clearly defined than at any former period." He then went on to specify the treasure trove of human knowledge that had accumulated over the past two centuries, it was about to be called the Enlightenment, and which constituted a kind of intellectual or philosophical equivalent of the nearly boundless natural resources waiting to be developed in the West. It was the fortuitous conjunction of these two vast reservoirs of philosophical and physical wealth that defined America's national interest and made it so special. At this auspicious period, he wrote, the United States came into existence as a nation, and if their citizens should not be completely free and happy, the fault will be entirely their own. The modern British philosopher Isaiah Berlin once described the different perspectives that political leaders bring to the management of world affairs as the difference between the hedgehog and the fox. The hedgehog knows one big thing, and the fox knows many little things. Washington was an archetypal hedgehog, and the one big thing he knew was that America's future as a nation lay to the west in its development over the next century of a continental empire. One of the reasons he devoted so much time and energy to planning the construction of canals and shared in the misguided belief of his fellow Virginians that the Potomac constituted a direct link to the river system of the interior was that he knew in his bones that the energy of the American people must flow in that direction. Europe might contain all the cultural capitals and current world powers, but in terms of America's national interest, it was a mere sideshow and distraction. The future lay in those forests he had explored as a young man. All this he understood intuitively by the time of his first retirement in 1783. Grand visions, even ones that prove as prescient as Washington's, must nevertheless negotiate the damnable particularities that history in the short run tosses up before history in the long run arrives to validate the vision. In Washington's case, the most obvious corollary to his view of American national interest was the avoidance of a major war during the gestative phase of national development. It so happened, however, that England and France were engaged in a century-old struggle for dominance of Europe and international supremacy, a struggle in which both the French and Indian War and the American Revolution were merely peripheral sideshows, and which would only end with Napoleon's defeat at Waterloo in 1815. Washington's understanding of the proper American response to this global conflict was crystal clear. I trust that we shall have too just a sense of our own interest to originate any cause that may involve us in it, he wrote in 1794, and I ardently wish we may not be forced into it by the conduct of other nations. If we are permitted to improve without interruption, the great advantages which nature and circumstances have placed within our reach, many years will not revolve before we may be ranked not only among the most respectable, but among the happiest people on earth. The linchpin of his foreign policy as president, it followed naturally, was the Proclamation of Neutrality, 1793, which declared America an impartial witness to the ongoing European conflict. His constant refrain throughout his presidency emphasized the same point, even offering an estimate of the likely duration of America's self-imposed alienation from global politics. Every true friend to this country must see and feel that the policy of it is not to embroil ourselves with any nation whatsoever, but to avoid their disputes and politics, and if they will harass one another, to avail ourselves of the neutral conduct we have adopted. 20 years' peace, with such an increase of population and resources as we have a right to expect, added to our remote situation from the jarring powers, will, in all probability, enable us, in a just cause, to bid defiance to any power on earth. In a sense, it was a fresh application of the same strategic lesson he had learned as head of the Continental Army, namely to avoid engagement with a superior force until the passage of time made victory possible, what we might call the strategy of enlightened procrastination. In retrospect, and with all the advantages of hindsight, Washington's strategic insights as president were every bit as foresighted as his strategic insights as commander-in-chief during the American Revolution, right down to his timing estimate of 20 years, which pretty much predicted the outbreak of the War of 1812. Since Washington's seminal insight was also the core piece of foreign policy wisdom offered in the farewell address, and since every major American statesman of the era also embraced the principle of neutrality as an obvious maxim, the meaning of the farewell address would seem to be incontrovertible, its message beyond controversy. But that was not at all how the message was heard at the time, in part because there was a deep division within the revolutionary generation that Washington was trying to straddle over just what a policy of American neutrality should look like, and in part because there was an alternative vision of the national interest circulating in the higher reaches of the political leadership, another opinion about where history was headed that could also make potent claims on the legacy of the American Revolution. All this had come to a head in Washington's second term in the debate over Jay's Treaty, creating the greatest crisis of Washington's presidency, the most virulent criticism of his monarchical tendencies, and the immediate context for every word he wrote in the farewell address. Jay's Treaty was a landmark in the shaping of American foreign policy. In 1794, Washington had sent Chief Justice John Jay to London to negotiate a realistic bargain that avoided a war with England at a time when the United States was ill-prepared to fight one. Jay returned in 1795 with a treaty that accepted the fact of English naval and commercial supremacy, and implicitly endorsed a pro-English version of American neutrality. It recognized England's right to retain tariffs on American exports while granting English imports most favored status in the United States. It implicitly accepted English impressment of American sailors. It also committed the United States to compensate English creditors for outstanding pre-revolutionary debts, most of which were owed by Virginia's planters. In return for these concessions, the English agreed to submit claims by American merchants for confiscated cargoes to arbitration, and to abide by the promise made in the Treaty of Paris, 1783, to evacuate its troops from their posts on the western frontiers. In effect, Jay's treaty was a repudiation of the Franco-American alliance of 1778, which had been so instrumental in gaining French military assistance for the winning of the American Revolution. While the specific terms of the treaty were decidedly one-sided in England's favor, the consensus reached by most historians who have studied the subject is that Jay's treaty was a shrewd bargain for the United States. It bet, in effect, on England rather than France as the hegemonic European power of the future, which proved prophetic. It recognized the massive dependence of the American economy on trade with England. In a sense, it was a precocious preview of the Monroe Doctrine, 1823, for it linked American security and economic development to the British fleet, which provided a protective shield of incalculable value throughout the 19th century. Mostly, it postponed war with England until America was economically and politically more capable of fighting one. The long-term advantages of Jay's treaty, however, were wholly invisible to most Americans in the crucible of the moment. Sensing the unpopularity of the pact, Washington attempted to keep its terms secret until the Senate had voted. But word leaked out in the summer of 1795 and then spread, as Madison put it, like an electric velocity to every part of the Union. Jay later claimed that the entire eastern seaboard was illuminated each evening by protesters burning him in effigy. In New York, Hamilton was struck in the head by a rock while attempting to defend the treaty to a crowd. John Adams recalled that Washington's house in Philadelphia was surrounded by an innumerable multitude from day to day, buzzing, demanding war against England, cursing Washington, and crying success to the French patriots and virtuous Republicans. Any concession to British economic and military power no matter how strategically astute, seemed a betrayal of the very independence won in the Revolution. Washington predicted that after a few months of contemplation, when passion shall have yielded to sober reason, the current may possibly turn. But in the meantime, this government in relation to France and England may be compared to a ship between the rocks of Scylla and Charybdis. To make matters worse, the debate over the treaty prompted a constitutional crisis. Perhaps the most graphic illustration of the singular status that Washington enjoyed was the decision of the Constitutional Convention to deposit the minutes of its secret deliberations with him for safekeeping. He, therefore, had exclusive access to the official record of the convention and used it to argue that the clear intent of the framers was to vest the treaty-making power with the executive branch, subject to the advice and consent of 2/3 of the Senate. Madison, however, had kept his own extensive notes on the debates at the Constitutional Convention and carried them down to share with Jefferson, who was in retirement at Monticello. Although a careful reading of Madison's notes on the debates revealed that Washington was correct, and indeed that Madison himself had been one of the staunchest opponents of infringements on executive power over foreign policy at the convention, Jefferson managed to conclude that the House was intended to be an equal partner in approving all treaties, going so far as to claim that the body was the sovereign branch of the government empowered to veto any treaty it wished, thereby annihilating the whole treaty-making power of the executive branch. "I trust the popular branch of our legislature will disapprove of it," Jefferson wrote from Monticello, "and thus rid us of this infamous act, which is really nothing more than a treaty of alliance between England and the Anglo-men of this country against the legislatures and people of the United States." The actual debate in the House in the fall and winter of 1795 proceeded under Madison's more cautious leadership and narrower interpretation of the Constitution. Jefferson's position would have recreated the hapless and hamstrung conditions that he himself had decried while serving as Minister to France under the Articles of Confederation, essentially holding American foreign policy hostage to congressional gridlock and the divisive forces of domestic politics. Madison instead argued that the implementation of Jay's treaty required the approval of the House for all provisions dependent on funding. This achieved the desired result, blocking the treaty while avoiding a frontal assault on executive power. Madison served as the floor leader of the opposition in the House during the debate that raged throughout the winter and spring of 1796. At the start, he enjoyed an overwhelming majority and regarded his position as impregnable. But as the weeks rolled on, he experienced firsthand the cardinal principle of American politics in the 1790s. Whoever went face to face against Washington was destined to lose. The majority started to melt away in March. John Adams observed bemusedly that "Mr. Madison looks worried to death, pale, withered, haggard." When the decisive vote came in April, Madison attributed his defeat to "the exertions and influence of aristocracy, Anglicism, and mercantilism, led by the banks, the British merchants, the insurance companies." Jefferson was more candid. Jay's treaty had passed, he concluded, because of the gigantic prestige of Washington, the one man who outweighs them all in influence over the people. Jefferson's sense of frustration had reached its breaking point a few weeks earlier when, writing to Madison, he quoted a famous line from Washington's favorite play, Joseph Addison's Cato, and applied it to Washington himself. "A curse on his virtues. They've undone his country." What could Jefferson's extreme reaction possibly mean? After all, from our modern perspective, Washington's executive leadership throughout the debate over Jay's treaty was nothing less than we would expect from a strong president whose authority to shape foreign policy is taken for granted. We also know the course he was attempting to steer, a middle passage between England and France that required tacking back and forth to preserve American neutrality and avoid war, turned out to be the correct policy. But in this instance, hindsight does not make us clairvoyant so much as blind to the ghosts and goblins that floated above the political landscape in the 1790s. What we might describe as admirably strong executive leadership struck Jefferson and his Republican followers as the arbitrary maneuverings of a monarch. And what appears in retrospect like a prudent and far-sighted vision of the national interest looked to Jefferson like a betrayal of the American Revolution. For Jefferson also had a national vision and a firm conviction about where American history was headed, or at least where it ought to be headed. The future he felt in his bones told him that the true spirit of 76, most eloquently expressed in the language he had drafted for the Declaration of Independence, was a radical break with the past and with all previous versions of political authority. Like Voltaire, Jefferson longed for the day when the last king would be strangled with the entrails of the last priest. The political landscape he saw in his mind's eye was littered with the dead bodies of despots and corrupt courtiers, a horizon swept clean of all institutions capable of coercing American citizens from pursuing their happiness as they saw fit. Thomas Paine's The Rights of Man, 1791, captured the essence of his vision more fully than any other book of the age, depicting, as it did, a radical transformation of society once the last vestiges of feudalism were destroyed and the emergence of a utopian world in which the essential discipline of government was internalized within the citizenry. The only legitimate form of government in the end was self-government. Shortly after his return to the United States in 1790, Jefferson began to harbor the foreboding sense that the American Revolution, as he understood it, had been captured by alien forces. As we have seen, the chief villain and core counter-revolutionary character in the Jeffersonian drama was Alexander Hamilton, and the most worrisome feature on the political landscape was Hamilton's financial scheme, with its presumption of a consolidated federal government possessing many of the powers over the states that Parliament had exercised over the colonies. Under Hamilton's diabolical leadership, the United States seemed to be recreating the very political and economic institutions. The National Bank became the most visible symbol of the accumulating corruption that the Revolution had been designed to destroy. Jefferson developed a full-blooded conspiracy theory in which bankers, speculators, federal office holders, and a small but powerful congregation of closet Tories permanently alienated from the agrarian majority, "they all live in cities," he wrote, had captured the meaning of the Revolution and were now proceeding to strangle it to death behind the closed doors of investment houses and within the faraway corridors of the Federalist government in New York and Philadelphia. Exactly where Washington fit in this horrific picture is difficult to determine. After all, he presumably knew something about the meaning and purpose of the Revolution, having done more than any man to assure its success. As Jefferson's critics were quick to observe, the man ensconced at Monticello had never fired a shot in anger throughout the war. Initially, Jefferson simply refused to assign Washington any culpability for the Federalist conspiracy, somehow suggesting that the person at the very center of the government was wholly oblivious to the schemes swirling around him. At some unspoken level of understanding, Jefferson recognized that Washington was the American untouchable, and that any effort to include him in the indictment immediately placed his entire case against the Federalists on the permanent defensive. Jefferson's posture toward Washington shifted perceptibly in 1794. The catalyst for the change was the Whiskey Rebellion, a popular insurgency in four counties of western Pennsylvania protesting an excise tax on whiskey. Washington viewed the uprising as a direct threat to the authority of the federal government and called out the militia, a massive 13,000-man army, to squelch the uprising. Jefferson regarded the entire affair as a shameful repetition of the Shays Rebellion fiasco nearly a decade earlier, in which a healthy and essentially harmless expression of popular discontent by American farmers, so he thought, had prompted an excessive and unnecessary military response. While his first instinct was to blame Hamilton for the whole sorry mess, Washington's speech justifying the action could not be so easily dismissed. Jefferson denounced Washington's speech as shreds of stuff from Aesop's Fables and Tom Thumb. In Jefferson's new version of the Federalist Conspiracy, Washington was an unknowing and somewhat pathetic accomplice, like an overaged captain in his cabin who was sound asleep while a rogue of a pilot, presumably Hamilton, has run them into an enemy's port. Washington was certainly the grand old man of the American Revolution, but his grandeur had now been eclipsed by his age, providing the Hamiltonians with the sanction of a name which has done too much good not to be sufficient to cover harm also. Washington simply did not have control of the government and was inadvertently lending credibility to the treacheries being hatched all around him. Washington, in effect, was senile. While hardly true, this explanation had the demonstrable advantage of permitting Jefferson's vision of a Federalist conspiracy to congeal in a plausible pattern that formed around Washington without touching him directly. Jefferson was also careful never to utter any of his criticisms of Washington in public. But in his private correspondence with trusted Republicans, he developed the image of an old soldier past his prime, reading speeches he did not write and could not comprehend, lingering precariously in the misty edges of incompetence, a hollow hulk of his former greatness. The most famous letter in this mode, famous because it eventually found its way into the newspapers against Jefferson's will, was prompted by the passage of Jay's treaty. "It would give you a fever," Jefferson wrote to his Italian friend Philip Mazzei, "were I to name to you the apostates who have gone over to these heresies, men who were Samsons in the field and Solomons in the council, but who have had their heads shorn by the harlot of England." Since there was only one person who could possibly merit the mantle of America's Samson and Solomon, Jefferson's customary sense of discretion allowed him to make his point without mentioning the name. But everybody knew. One final and all-important piece of the Jeffersonian vision transcended the troubling particularities of domestic politics altogether. As Jefferson saw it, the American Revolution had been merely the opening shot in a global struggle against tyranny that was destined to sweep over the world. "This ball of liberty, I believe most piously," he predicted, "is now so well in motion that it will roll around the globe." Whereas Washington regarded the national interest as a discrete product of political and economic circumstances, shaping the policies of each nation-state as a specific moment in history, Jefferson envisioned a much larger global pattern of ideological conflict in which all nations were aligned for or against the principles that America had announced to the world in 1776. The same moralistic dichotomy that Jefferson saw inside the United States between discernible heroes and villains, he also projected into the international arena. For Jefferson, all specific decisions about American foreign policy occurred within the context of this overarching, indeed almost cosmic pattern. Therefore, While Jefferson could talk with genuine conviction about American neutrality and the need to remain free of European entanglements, thereby sounding much like Washington, his version of American neutrality was decidedly different. He did not view the clash between England and France for supremacy in Europe as a distant struggle far removed from America's long-term national interest. Instead, he saw the French Revolution as the European continuation of the spirit of 76. He acknowledged that the random violence and careening course of the French Revolution were lamentable developments, but he insisted they were merely a passing chapter in a larger story of triumphant global revolution. "I am convinced they, the French, will triumph completely," he wrote in 1794, "and the consequent disgrace of the invading tyrants is destined, in the order of events, to kindle the wrath of the people of Europe against those who have dared to embroil them in such wickedness, and to bring at length kings, nobles, and priests to the scaffolds which they have been so long deluging with blood." In one moment of revolutionary euphoria, he dismissed all critics of mass executions in France as blind to the historic issues at stake. The liberty of the whole earth was depending on the issue of that contest, he observed in 1793, and was ever such a prize won with so little blood? My own affections have been deeply wounded by some of the martyrs to this cause, but rather than it should have failed, I would rather have seen half the earth desolated. Were there but an Adam and Eve left in every country and left free, it would be better than it is now. If France was the revolutionary hero in this international drama, England was the counter-revolutionary villain. Jefferson's highly moralistic language, castigating George III and the English government in the Declaration of Independence, was not just propaganda, at least for Jefferson. It reflected his genuine conviction that England was an inherently corrupt society, the bastion of monarchical power, aristocratic privilege, and courtly intrigue. Since Washington had spent 8 years sending American soldiers to their death in battle against Great Britain, one might expect that he harbored even more hostile opinions toward his former adversary. But he did not. Jefferson's Anglophobia was more virulent in part because it was more theoretical, a moral conclusion that followed naturally from the moralistic categories he carried around in his head. If he wanted to stigmatize a political opponent, the worst name he could call him was Angloman. For Jefferson, France represented the brightest future prospects. England represented the dead hand of the past. At the nub of his opposition to Jay's treaty then was his utter certainty that it threw the weight of the United States onto the wrong side of history. "The Anglo-men have, in the end, got their treaty through," he observed from his mountaintop in 1796, "and so far have triumphed over the cause of republicanism." But their victory, painful as it was to witness, had also exposed their vulnerability, for it was now quite obvious that nothing can support them but the colossus of the president's merits with the people, and the moment he retires, that his successor, if a monocrat, will be overborne by the Republican sense. In the meantime, patience. Just a few weeks before he wrote these words, Jefferson had felt the urge to assure Washington that, contrary to the gossip circulating in the corridors and byways of Philadelphia, he was not responsible for the various rumors describing the president as a quasi-senile front man for the Federalist conspiracy against the vast majority of the American people. The historical record makes it perfectly clear, to be sure, that Jefferson was orchestrating the campaign of vilification, which had its chief base of operations in Virginia and its headquarters at Monticello. But Jefferson was the kind of man who could have passed a lie detector test confirming his integrity, believing as he did that the supreme significance of his larger cause rendered conventional distinctions between truth and falsehood superfluous. Washington's response was designed to let Jefferson know that his professed innocence itself sounded like the defensive comment of a guilty man, and that Washington already knew a good deal more than Jefferson realized about who was whispering what behind his back. "If I had entertained any suspicions before," wrote Washington, "the assurances you have given me of the contrary would have removed them. But the truth is, I harbored none. Translation, your protests confirm my suspicions." Then Washington parted the curtain covering his soul just enough to show Jefferson a glimpse of what he truly felt. "As you have mentioned the subject yourself, it would not be frank, candid, or friendly to conceal that your conduct has been represented as derogatory from the opinion I had conceived you entertained to me." Translation, I am onto your game. "That to your particular friends and connections you have described, and they have described me, as a person under a dangerous influence." Translation, my sources are impeccable. "My answer has invariably been that I had never discovered anything in the conduct of Mr. Jefferson to raise suspicions in my mind of his insincerity." Translation, I have not done unto others what they have been doing unto me. Washington concluded with an impassioned defense of his support for Jay's treaty. "I was using my utmost exertions to establish a national character of our own, independent, as far as our obligations and justice would permit, of every nation of the earth. But somehow he had been accused of being the enemy of one nation, France, and subject to the influence of another, England. And to prove it, that every act of my administration should be tortured, and the most insidious misrepresentations of them be made, by giving one side only of a subject, and that, too, in such exaggerated and indecent terms as could scarcely be applied to a Nero, a notorious defaulter, or even to a common pickpocket. But enough of this. I have already gone farther in the expression of my feelings than I intended." Translation, even this mere glimpse into my soul is more than you deserve, my former friend. For the next year, Jefferson attempted to sustain at least the veneer of a friendship with Washington by writing him letters in the Virginia gentleman mode, avoiding politics and foreign policy altogether, focusing instead on his crop rotation scheme at Monticello, the vagaries of the weather, his vetch and wheat crop, and, a rather potent metaphor, the best way to spread manure. Washington responded in kind, that is, until the newspapers printed Jefferson's old letter to Philip Matze, the one about America's degenerate Samson and Solomon. Then all communication from Mount Vernon to Monticello ceased forever. Beyond the purely personal dimensions of their estrangement, beyond Washington's sense of betrayal and Jefferson's artful minuet with duplicity, this episode provides an invaluable clue to the larger and more impersonal political concerns that were on Washington's mind when he sat down to compose the farewell address. They went far past the loss of Jefferson's friendship, important though it was, because Jefferson's behavior was symptomatic of more than a betrayal of trust. It accurately reflected a fundamental division within the revolutionary generation over the meaning of the revolution and the different versions of America's abiding national interest that followed naturally from that disagreement. The words that were used at the time, or the words employed by historians later to capture the essence of the argument, are mere labels, Federalists versus Republicans, pro-English versus pro-French versions of American neutrality. Underlying the debate that surfaced in full-blown fashion over Jay's treaty lurked a classic confrontation between those who wished America's revolutionary energies to be harnessed to the larger purposes of nation-building and those who interpreted that very process as a betrayal of the revolution itself. From Washington's perspective, the republic established by the Constitution created a government of laws that must be obeyed once the duly elected representatives had reached a decision. That was why he had acted so decisively to put down the Whiskey Rebellion, and why he expected compliance with Jay's Treaty once its terms were approved by the Congress. From Jefferson's perspective, on the other hand, all laws and treaties that reined in the liberating impulses of the Revolution were illegitimate. That was why he regarded the suppression of the Whiskey Rebellion as reprehensible. Were not these Pennsylvania farmers protesting taxes to which they did not consent? As for Jay's treaty, who in his right mind would countenance the acceptance of neo-colonial status within the hated British Empire? Not obeying, but rather violating such unjust laws and treaties was the obligation of every citizen. Was this not the higher law that Americans should follow arm and arm again with their trusted French brethren? In this formulation, political behavior that was, strictly speaking, traitorous and treasonable was, in fact, the only course that enjoyed the sanction of America's most hallowed revolutionary principles. Perhaps the most extreme example of this Republican mentality in action was James Monroe, a zealous Jefferson protege currently serving as the minister to France. Though not in Jefferson's league as a thinker or political strategist, Monroe more than made up for these deficiencies by embracing the core articles of the Republican faith with near total abandon. He assured his French hosts that Jay's treaty would never be approved by Congress, that the vast majority of the American people were eager to join France in war with England, that the U.S. government stood ready to advance France a $5 million loan to subsidize its military expenses, and that when none of these wild predictions materialized, the French government should patiently but firmly disregard all messages from the American president, since he obviously spoke for the aristocratic Anglo-men and would soon be hurled from office by the people. In the meantime, the French should feel perfectly free to retaliate against American ships on the high seas. When they began to do so in the spring of 1796, and the first prize confiscated was a ship named the Mount Vernon, Monroe thought it was a providential version of poetic justice. And by the way, he hoped that Benjamin Franklin Bache at the Aurora would see fit to publish, under a pseudonym, of course, some of his confidential communiques from Paris protesting the most outrageous provisions of Jay's treaty. All this from America's official emissary to the French government. A slightly less extreme, but infinitely more befuddled example of the same mentality had surfaced inside Washington's cabinet at the very moment he was making the decision to send Jay's treaty to the Senate in August of 1795. The successor to Jefferson as Secretary of State was Edmund Randolph, like Monroe, a second-tier member of the Virginia dynasty, whose principal recommendation for the job was an unblinking loyalty to Washington, but whose chief political habit was to blink incessantly at any decision that demanded clear convictions of his own. Poor Randolph, an otherwise decent man who was clearly in over his head, had granted an interview with the outgoing French minister to the United States, Joseph Fouché, who had then transcribed the high points of the conversation in a dispatch that was subsequently intercepted at sea by a British cruiser. The British were only too willing to forward the dispatch to the American government. The day after Washington read it out loud to the full cabinet, Randolph submitted his resignation. What the Fauché dispatch claimed and what we know on the basis of subsequent scholarship are not synonymous. According to Fauché, Randolph requested a bribe as part of some mysterious scheme in support of the Whiskey Rebellion. Although Randolph was almost certainly innocent of this charge, the whole tenor and tone of Fauché's account revealed Randolph confiding his personal opposition to the entire domestic and foreign policy of the Washington administration, lamenting the ascendance of a financiering class that aimed at the restitution of monarchy, decrying the enslavement of American trade to the audacity of England, depicting Randolph himself as the sole voice of the patriotic party within the government, and the last hope for bringing a sadly dazed and thoroughly confused President Washington to his senses. Randolph's unfortunate utterances were not truly treasonable, as he spent the remainder of his life trying vainly and in his foggy style to explain. In truth, he had simply allowed himself to get caught engaging in the same talk that Jefferson was conveying to friends and Monroe was sputtering out loud to anyone in Paris who would listen. The notion that a diabolical conspiracy of money men and monarchists had seized control of the federal government under Washington's very nose was so widespread within Virginia's political elite that they had lost all perspective on how conspiratorial their own words sounded to those denied the vision. And so, when Washington sat down to draft his farewell address, three salient features rose up out of the immediate political terrain to command his attention. First, he needed to demonstrate that, while poised for retirement, he was still very much in charge, that those rumors of creeping senility and routinized ineptitude were demonstrably wrong. Second, he wanted to carve out a middle course and do so in a moderate tone that, together, pushed his most ardent critics to the fringes of the ongoing debate, where their shrill accusations, loaded language, and throbbing moral certainty could languish in the obscurity they deserved. Third, the all-time master of exits wanted to make his final departure from the public stage the occasion for explaining his own version of what the American Revolution meant. Above all, it meant hanging together as a united people, much as the Continental Army had hung together once before, so that those who were making foreign policy into a divisive device in domestic politics, all in the name of America's revolutionary principles, were themselves inadvertently subverting the very cause they claimed to champion. He was stepping forward into the battle one final time, planting his